so. He'd established a line of temples where the people could gather at the new year all dressed in white, bringing their rich gifts, feasting and dancing, having a wonderful time while celebrating the creation of the world. First of all, the temple was the home of the arts, and most of all, the temple of the arts and science. You had to have the portraits of the ancestors, and that was, well, they have the records. The library was absolutely vital because those were where the genealogy was kept, and the, well, that's what Bresson decided too. When you talk about the house of life, the library, that means genealogy and records, and your history is kept there. And they had the sacred images, and the portraits we find from the most remote periods, I mean 6,000-7,000 years ago, are exquisite works, true works of art, and the paintings and so on. So it goes, all your civilization comes from the temple. The temple itself was a sacred edifice built according to strict rules of divine proportions. Vitruvius's great work on architecture. Everything has to be significant in the structure to harmonize with the universe itself. The all-important timing of rites and festivals required close observation of the heavens. There were astronomical observatories, these places were. Divination by the study of liver and other parts of animals, the sacrificial animals of birds. Well, that led to advanced medical art. The early reapportionment of fields. They have to do refields on lands. They're reapportioned every year, make new deals. That was geometry. They had to be very accurate about that. It was one time to make a complete contracts as the center of law there. Then talk about the hyper of life. Thoth, the librarian, is addressed as, quote, the Lord of divine words, keeper of the secret knowledge, who established speech and writing, causing the temples to flourish. And all goes there. He assisted the lady of writing, who was the great secretary and so forth. Well, here one of many instructions. Well, here's in the coffin text, which is, you know, very old, from about 130 through 146, they're all formula on how to seal your family to yourself in the other world. And it's done legally and lawfully, and this is how it's done. I have an example here. Here. The text. I come before you, exalted one. He's talking about the council there. Exalted one, both masculine and feminine. Oh, great one. The great one, the Eternal Council, in concurrence with the council, which has approved the sealing of a certificate ordering my family to be returned to me. Thoth has said to me, the order has been sealed, giving you his voice. This order has accordingly been validated. This correct writing for the Lady of Appearances is to the effect that my family is to be given to me. The Lady is Seshat, the secretary, of course, who from prehistoric times was in charge of records in that. And here's coffin text 143. So the party of the first part, this is a legal document, see, this N, N is a person's name. This N has taken his seat in the west beside the great God. He has opened the mouth of the earth, where the people are buried, the gates of Geb. He has assembled the dependents of this N before him, along with his proper family. He has written down a multitude of persons, names, male and female. He goes among those upon the shore, waiting to hear the word. He hears those within their shrines, in their tombs. This end unites the dependents with the coming of his family of end to him. A multitude has surrounded this end. This end is the same person we're talking about, see, has written down those spirits which until then have remained hidden in places in the west. They give the Ba to end, to give glory to end, causing the caves to open within and to release those who are in them in the noon. This end releases their bonds that they may walk in the light. This end issues the command for breath and strength, which is stronger than the gates of hell. He's actually using that expression, the Akar, to live after death even as does Ray, as Ray does every day, to live after death. If his dependents are not united with him in the amended, then he will come down to the lake of the land and the devours, and flames shall come forth against those who've prevented this from happening. So there's a threat if you can't deliver the dead. Well, there's a long spiel of that, though. Somebody should do some work on that. A document for uniting a family of end to him who is in the other world. I have to skip here. If they are gathered, he shall not lose them. The interesting thing is there, his staff shall not be removed from his hand, using the same expression they do in Israel. The staff shall not depart from Jacob. That's the Shevet, the Ark of the Covenant, the staff of the family, and the individual seal. So this language of Israel, the Shevet shall not depart. If he fails to gather them in the beyond, then there would be no great family reunions on earth with the usual parties and feasting. When Ed arrives in the other world, there's an interesting scene. The family is working in the field. His sister and then sister, the woman who was in charge of the great field, said, "See, you have come, joyful and happy-hearted." She runs to meet him. She calls out to him. So she says to him, "Give answer. Has there been granted to you a valid decree for this family of yours?" And then has gone down happy and rejoicing, for his family has been given to him. The great one of Enon's family have gone down joyfully. Their hearts are full at meeting him. They have left their plows, their utensils, their kebab, their idols, and their kinnikou, means pots and cups, lunch stuff, their canteens. They've left them, they're working in the field, you see. They all come and rush to meet him. A very homey scene, you see. Conclusion, assembling the family, father, mother, friends, associates, children, women, concubines, servants, workers, anything belonging to a man for him in the realm of the dead. So you do this work so you can be with your loved ones hereafter. They really had it developed to a fine art. Well, anyway, you've got to get on here. What was the endowment? What did they do when they got to the temple, you see? Well, receives. What are you endowed with? Well, you're endowed with the knowledge and protections you need to reach the next world safely. As with us, when meant to the table for an endowment, given all the equipment, information, certification that we'd need to make passage for this world to the next. To our surprise, this is the main theme of all temple and funerary literature. You get through that. As Lepsius puts it in the introduction to the first edition of the Book of the Dead, which we possess here in the BYU Library. In fact, it was Sage's own copy. The great Jeep taught Aiden owned this, and we have his copy here, which this is from, of the Lepsius first edition of the Book of the Dead. He says the text supplies only to the deceased, the one who holds it, the things he will need on the long journey after this earthly life. There is described to him where he is to be going, what he does, what he hears and sees, and the prayers and addresses which he must give to whatever gods or others he meets. The surprise is that the best account of the endowment is found in the Joseph Smith Papyrus, number 4, the Book of Breathings. The key to the endowment is the eternal progression of the pilgrim from one state, blessed state, to another. And the new school, they're aware of the appalling physical distances and space. They think in terms of space now, you see, as I say, talking about the mummy case as a module. As you approach the camp, now see, all that come to the temple come as pilgrims and have to live in tents, and there's a camp there. As you approach the camp, now this is taking on with Brother Rick's here, you assure them that you're there. You call attention to yourself and say, "It's safe. This is the Roman gesture too. I'm not armed, I'm safe, and I'm calling attention." That's the way to do it. Remember, you call out with upraised hands, "Here I am. Hear the words of my mouth. I have something." This is the way you call your attention, at the same time showing you come in peace and friendship. That you do at a distance. That's the sign that you see. That's a sign you give at a distance as you call out. Upon reaching the gate, you print it, then a token. Now, a token means to touch. To teach, to touch, and other things, a token, taken, well, is teach the Old English and so forth. You have to have a token, a personal thing. You're closer up now, you see. You've been trusted to come that far. And this is a tessera hospitalis. I've written some articles on that, too, in various journals. Admitting one to a closed group or party or a club, you have to have this ticket or token or a grip or sign. That goes too. It's the lodge sign, you see. Presented to the doorkeeper, the herald trained in such matters, and the Book of Mormon's right in on that. The Holy One of Israel is the keeper of the gate. There's the gatekeeper, and he employs no servant there because the names are secret. And the Lord will take your hand and you will exchange the name with him. And then it adds, he cannot be deceived. You cannot deceive this keeper of the gate, you see. As you come in, so you give the token, which means to touch or grab or hold. What do you mean by token? So next comes the token when you're closer up. And then, when you're closest to Vat, as you pass through the veil, as the high priest does through the veil on the Day of Atonement, you whisper the name that nobody knows except you. And then you whisper your name. So it can't be picked up. There's a famous story, Egyptian story, about how Isis tried to get his true name from Re. She used some wild devices so that she could get his name and endow her son with the priesthood, because she was always jealous on behalf of her son Horus. So there, someone's trying to get your name. Don't give it away. It is very, very secret, you see. Well, to be at the temple, you have to get there, as you mentioned that before. So, yeah, that's correct. So, every endowment, yeah, you have to reach the place. Once you've arrived, the traveling continues. This is the point. This is not the end. You continue there. When you get to the temple, you continue your journey for the passage. Many studies written now about the Egyptian temple. Is a passage. The temple itself is a passage. You go farther and farther and farther, and you get out. Well, say at Dendera, that magnificent temple, beautifully preserved. You go through these various, you go up and up and up. It gets lighter, lighter, lighter. And fine, you depart from the roof through the veil, and you go into the next stage. And we have a great and marvelous papyrus, the Leiden T32, which tells how you go from one endowment to the next. When you've left, remember, when you've gone through the veil of one temple, you never go back again. You receive only one endowment. You can come back and work for others, but you receive yours. Where do you go then? You go to the next one, you see. And this T32 lists no less than 696 endowments that you have to get as you progress through eternity. So you have a lot to look forward to. But we're assured you will never be bored, because each is different. You do, what's his name, a very good teacher about the name of Aspen has written about this, because you never know what's coming up next. You have the vaguest idea what comes next. Each is a great and glorious surprise. So you'll never be bored as you go, because life is passing on. You do keep moving. You do keep progressing. We say eternal progression. That's exactly what this is. You go from one, the next endowment, but the next endowment is a totally different experience, not like this one at all. This is the Egyptian temple. It's quite a story. But, the suppliant, upon arriving, removes his dusty clothes to be washed, anointed, dressed in white robes and slippers. Then he receives a new name, secret in his own, proceeds from chamber to chamber, from level to level in the temple. He's still progressive. He's still a pilgrim as he passes through the temple. After passing through the veil to depart, he never returns again, but proceeds on his way to the next temple to attire a higher endowment. Well, now becomes the question, what happened to all the temples? Got to hurry up. What happened to the temples? Then they had them all. Well, the reply to that question is well documented. They were privatized. Remember, these temples were free from taxation, free to engage in trade under the guise of charitable foundations, you see, accumulating land grants from the king or the nobility, along with the serfs that go with the land to cultivate them. They ended up owning all the property and becoming enormously rich, as the Cistercians did when Henry VIII decided to take it all away from them. They became just too rich. They became owning everything was owned by the temple. So they changed their nature entirely. The priesthood of Thebes grabbed everything and finally aspire to take over the rule of the country. Well, you have the case of Win-Amun, the high priest of Thebes. He goes to Byblos to buy some logs, some cedar logs, to repair the temple of Amun. But his money is stolen on the way. And when he gets there, he asks the king of Amun, well, you'll give me credit for this, won't you? So the king says, well, let's bring out the records. So they bring out the records for hundreds of years back. And look, you people always paid cash on the line for cedar logs, and you're going to pay too. So then, when Amun has a fit and he threatens him, you see, with a mighty iron, aren't you overawed by Amun? See, that's the way they turned Amun into a good business. You better kick through or Amun will get you, as far as that goes. So this was what happened. I spent my mission up and down the Rhine, the Rhine Plain in Germany. It was medieval country and Catholic, and I traced every house in scores of villages, attracted every house, and got a pretty good idea of what's going on there. All up and down the length of the great river you find these great, magnificent cathedrals, like Cologne and Speyer and Freiburg. And next to the cathedral is the bishop's palace. The bishop, cathedral, of course, is a seat. It's a center from which the bishop operates. He preaches. It's his cathedra, from which he teaches, and all authority goes out from there. But he is the authority. This is the temple now, and next to him is the bishop's house. And that was the palace of the prince bishop. The dual role is taken over and presented by the notorious wicked. Well, we know all this from Longfellow, The Children's Hour. And I think of the Bishop of Bingham, the wicked Bishop of Bingham, in his Mouse Tower on the Rhine. right plunk in the middle of the Rhine is this tower, the Mouse Tower, this grim tower. Well, the bishop lived there, and he tithed everybody who went up the river. Everybody had to pay him, and he was oppressive of the peasants. He was wicked, and so on. This is what happened to the temples everywhere. They got to be paying business, and they became corrupt. Well, the priesthood, we get that in the Book of Mormon, too. Well, yes, these dark towers were keeps and dungeons under a curse. Oppressors of the peasants, doomed to fall. Right from the beginning, there's Golden Mycenae, Sacred Thebes, Troy itself, Camelot, Persepolis, Yomsburg, the House of Usher, San Simeon, all claim the powers of the temple over subjects. Under the castle was the realm of Pluto, or the caves where the dragon slept, guarding the gold, the cursed Rhine gold. You see, there it is, the thing is phony, so it all has got to be wiped out and disappear. So it's a tragic picture, you see, the Ring of the Nibelung. The once free inhabitants of the land, you find, and here's the dragon, guarding the cursed gold, and under him are the gnomes, the slaves, the former inhabitants of the land, working away under compulsion to bring out more gold. The whole thing, this is the way it works now, and the prince bishop gets it all. Of all the people to tell us how this took place, well, Aristophanes is the best, because he can be as irreverent as he wants to. His criminalist, his old man is a typical Joe. And he's having a hard time going, but because all the money's going in the wrong way. So he goes, because people are crooked, they're robbing each other. The smartest people are getting away with all of it. So he goes to go up to Zeus to complain in heaven, because Pluto down in the underworld has got all the business. When he gets there, he's told, well, I'm afraid you have to go down there to see him. He's working now in the outer office of Pluto. Joe, Zeus himself, it was too good a job to resist. Pluto offered him too much, he said. So this is the way it happened. It's a familiar story, we see it now, you see. But this should go out and ring all through the ages. This theme has been going on all the time. It gives a very interesting cast to our world history. Well, I'm talking much too long. This is terrible. Don't forgive me. Well, then, this is an important thing. The commercialized temple, the cloud-capped palaces, that stand out in bold contrast to the true solemn temples. Shakespeare said, I labored in most of those big cathedral places along the Rhine, and they won by frontal attacks, sheer assertion, overpowering display, a demonstration of might and glory. From the awesome horns of the Tibetan lamasery to the booming organs of the Byzantine court, an overpoweringly contrived theatrical production which overawed, and that's the nearest you'll come to converting. When Eusebius tells us, he was a personal friend of Constantine, he says, when you see Constantine march out in procession, a beam of sunlight hits his garment, which is completely covered with jewels from top to bottom, and it glitters like a Christmas tree. You felt you were in the presence of an angel of God. See, they put on a show, and that won. This mind-boggling theater was taken over by the West and combined the intoxication of the senses with the compelling force of mass action. No one can resist being swept along by the cheering section. Interquoset me and St. Augustine, I was one among them. He says, what everybody believes, I can believe, and I do believe, though I have no proof that it's so. If everybody believes it, I will believe it. And this is what it comes to here, you see. It was rhetoric which won the day. Rhetoric is high salesmanship. It's We see a lot of it this season. It was highly developed with great skill way back. Remember, Socrates argues with his friend Protagoras, who was guilty of opening a school of rhetoric, teach people to preach the law, to practice law, and engage in business. And to do that, you develop rhetoric, which Socrates quite frankly calls, he says it's an evil thing, it's making the lesser appear the better reason by the use of words. It's sales talk, it's PR, it's hype, and they developed it as we do today, and it kept up and it flourished until it ate up and took over everything. I wrote a long article on that once in Berkeley. Remember the title of my article was, used Augustine's expression, he says, I overcome by cupidity, I cultivated the victorious loquacity, the victorious fast talk. Overcome by greed, I went in for rhetoric and became a salesman, he says. It's exactly what he says. And you see what the techniques are. Now, the great rhetoricians who changed everything to rhetoric were all the great bishops of the 4th century, like Chrysostom and Augustine and his friend Ambrose of Milan and so forth. This power of rhetoric overwhelmed and absorbed everything. And that, along with the splendor, and then you come to the Baroque, where all the splendor of jewels and gold and something, it's something that knocks you out. I better stop here, this is awful. I another article in the Jewish Quarterly Review on the argument, when is a church a temple or not? They argued that at first. They didn't. No, they said it's another. Definitely the early Christians, because the earliest Christian writers said, we go up to the Temple Mount and look forward to the time when the Lord will restore the temple. We want a real temple. No, said the rhetoricians, a spiritual temple is what counts. That's the real thing. Well, they said spiritual, there are a dime a dozen. So there was quite an argument about that. This is too long. Oh, well, let's consider this now, a contrast, just a final word. Forgive this intrusion. Take a Saturday morning when I set out for a temple. I set out for a temple I've never been to before in the valley here. See what the contrast is. Now, Brother Pinnock has told us that. I've never heard the ground covered like that. He said everything I'd want to say, you see. He said just what should be said, and this is what happens on a Saturday morning. I set forth, and I tell no one where I'm going. I enter the temple without signing up. I don't have to sign up or anything. That's funny. I just flash a recommend, and they take it at face value. They don't ask my name. That's your tesser hospitalis. That's your temple token, you see. It admits me without argument. I have brought my temple clothes, and as Brother Pinnock says, they're just like everybody else's. There's no rank, there's no distinction, there's no Freemasonry or splendor, or none of that at all. Even if it's the president of the church, all the same. Well, what have we got here? This is not the same thing at all. And here is an absolute distinction. The glory of the vestments is one of the great assertions of the other temples. My friend Ted Hume, who was the minister of the official church, congregational church in Claremont, Pomona College, where I was teaching, he used to plug for, he said, we've got to introduce the ceremony into the congregational church. We've got to have processions and robes and incense and things like that to give dignity to the church. Well, it's just the opposite, of course, as far as that goes. But this, they count on that sort of thing, you see. But we don't. Then, the Masons are dedicated to gorgeous costumes and insignia of rank. None of that, absolutely none of it in the temple. I even shed my name before I can proceed and receive a secret name, which is never to be revealed to anyone ever, except a particular time and place, and that's the Lord himself. Having exchanged my identity for another, which remains secret, I proceed to receive the endowment. Some years ago, the presidency wisely abolished the custom of reporting in your quorum meetings how many temple visits you had that week. They abolished that. And I asked one of the presidency of that party, they do that? Well, it's none of your business. It's you alone who goes to the temple. It's as personal and private as anything can possibly be. It's your own salvation you're considering. And this is a different thing entirely. This has to do with the eternities. There have been what might be called manifestations in the temple, the most famous being the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. Even the Kirtland Temple was just individual manifestations, remember? They put them together and had quite a sheaf of them, as far as that goes. I'm sure there are many here who've had manifestations. I have too, won't tell anybody, but those things do come. And nothing we could do about it here. I was going to introduce this, but I think I will anyway. This is quite, I promise you, say no more. This is the cover, I should have given that to. This is the cover of the Ghost Sonata of Beethoven's Hammer Clavier Sonata. It's a mountain of noise with a beautiful middle movement. And he dedicates it to the temple, to the priest. And this is what he says in this dedication, to follow it out here, showing how they pour it on here. He says here, well, this is the cover of Beethoven's great and noisy Hammerklavier Sonata. It is dedicated, quote, to His Imperial Royal Highness, Eminent and Eminence, the Durchlauchtigsten. Now, a Durchlaucht means, dictionary tells us, most glorious, exalted, and serene. Durchlauchtig means supremely supreme, I have above that. But he says Durchlauchtigsten, he makes it a Durchlauchtigsten. He makes it a superlative. So the most sublime, 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 and then he follows it by the Lord Archduke. That isn't enough, he has to say Lord twice, the Herren, Herren, Erzherzog. The Lord, Lord Archduke, and he's still pouring it on. And then the interesting thing here is what it was to get to. Yes, no, he's this. The Archduke Rudolf of Austria, Cardinal, Archbishop of Olmutz. This is dedicated with the deepest awe, ehrfurcht, and reverence. Could glorification go any further than this thing? He just pours it on. The different thing, the bottom line is the interesting thing, he says, which says, property of, right here at the bottom, of the, oh, I've got it right here, oh, just like this, property of the publisher, all profits go to Artaria Corporation of Vienna. There's a prophet in it, it all goes to the corporation. He gets the compliments, the bishop gets all the compliments. Why should you pour it on like that? That's groveling as far as that goes, you know. And he signs himself Van Beethoven. That Van doesn't mean phone at all. That's just a Dutch name, meaning the village he came from. But no, they have to do this. So you see what's happened to the temple. And we're facing that sort of thing again, aren't we? A matter of values. But the simplicity. How this temple I described, I could go on describing this individual side of it, it's just yours. You leave without registering, you say, I'm going now. You don't have to sign a register to leave or anything like that, you just leave. And you come back again when you jolly well feel like it. It's a marvelous thing. So this is the nearest thing to an incorruptible. How could I be corrupted then? It's all between me and the Lord and no one else. That's what it is. Yes. I remember when I asked, when President Smith, George Albert Smith, about something in the temple, he says, I don't know the answer to that. You know, that's between you and the Lord. I don't meddle in your affairs. This is the nearest thing to an uncorruptible order of things you'll ever find. How can you corrupt it in this case? It's most marvelous. Well, what I do is thank Brother Pinnock for his talk. It boosted me, it cheered me up in my misery. And I thank you for listening. Well, I wish to bear testimony that I have many reasons for believing this is so, and it is, believe me. There is something, the temple has a future until that time when there'll be nothing else left in the world. I can't wait for that. But I bear testimony that the holiness of this work, the sacred calling of the Prophet Joseph Smith, and the divine institution of the temple in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
For additional information on this and other FARMS publications, call FARMS at 1-800-327-6715 or visit your local LDS bookstore.